What I want to do in these six sessions, starting this morning and ending on Saturday morning, is a theology of worship. I want to use biblical materials as we go along. Most of them, as you noticed on the bulletin board, I think most of the materials, the biblical materials, will be out of Romans, with the exception of one day when we'll take a look at 1 Corinthians 10 and 11. But the series itself is, in a sense, more systematic theology than it is strictly Bible study. I'm not going to make any apologies for that, but I do want to make some explanation. When people ask me what is systematic theology, I try to say, well, systematic theology is the theoretics, or the theory of Christianity. And it's, of course, very possible for all of us to be Christians without having any theory as to what Christianity is about or why we are Christians. I think if I were going to make a comparison, I would say what I do is sort of like what Mike Beaver does. He's a mechanic, and he keeps our cars and engines running, and he has to know all about the theory of engines. The rest of us can just get into our cars, turn a key, and drive away. But somebody has to know how to take them apart and put them together again. So the theory of auto mechanics is a useful, even necessary discipline, even though everybody doesn't do it. So also the theory of Christianity is a necessary discipline, even though all of us don't do it. Another analogy would be that the theory of Christianity is sort of like a cookbook is to cooking and eating. The recipe doesn't put a meal on the table, but somebody has to put recipes together so that we eventually do get meals cooked, and above all, the most important thing, that we get meals eaten. So I think the theory of Christian worship is like a cookbook. I think Lutherans are frequently more apt to take this kind of theory too seriously, as if it were the actual eating itself, or sometimes not seriously enough, as if we could get along without it altogether. And I think either one of those extremes, as if the theory were the food itself, or as if we could get along without a cookbook at all and just sort of throw things together indiscriminately, either of these are a problem. The fact is that we need to think once in a while consciously about what we are doing when we gather to worship, and most of all about what the relationship is between worship and our lives. I don't know exactly how valid my own credentials are for relating worship and life, but I'll tell you at least one story that has some things to do with my credentials. 2 years ago, I had a hemorrhoidectomy, and my colleague sent me a card while I was in the hospital. And on the card, they wrote, in a recent survey, it has been discovered that half of Lutheran seminary professors have hemorrhoids, and the other half are perfect asses. If you're... That's not the punchline. Wait a minute. They went on to say, if your surgeon is successful, you may have new status. Well, well, he was, and I do. So that's those are my credentials. This has nothing to do with it, but my students found a printed Hallmark card when I was in the hospital. It was just beautiful. On the outside it said, we've been talking to your doctor and he is very upset. On the inside it said, you've just got to stop asking him to kiss it and make it well. yes. I am glad that humor is not dead in the student generation. Okay, today I want to talk about worship then as serious. Herb Lindemann, who was one of the pioneers in the Lutheran liturgical movement, wrote a book that Augsburg published a couple of years ago called The New Mood in Lutheran Worship. And he says in this book that in its beginnings, the liturgical movement was a quest for life, vitality, and excitement in worship, in place of the dull and the dead monotony that seemed to characterize worship in his own youth. I think all of us know something about the dullness and the deadliness of worship. My favorite story is of the boy who comes to church and sees with his mother, and there's a banner in the narthex, and he says, "Mother, what is this banner with all the stars on it?" And she says, "My son, each one of those stars is for one of the young men of our parish who died in the service." "Which service?" he says, "8:15 or 10:30? I think if we were going to talk about the problems that we have in worship, we could sympathize with this boy. But it's a mistake for people, especially also for people who were involved in liturgical renewal, to think that the main task we have is simply to sort of liven things up again. This leads to all kinds of gimmickry in worship. And I got a book for review once some years ago, written by a very successful clergy person called 50 Ways to Increase Your Church Attendance. Why, he was offering something different for every Sunday. There was picture-taking Sunday. Everybody brings cameras along to church and take pictures of everybody else. There was old-fashioned Sunday. That's not a religious cocktail party. What it was everybody coming with butter churns and 19th-century dress and so on. There was creek baptizing Sunday, where everybody went to a river. There were all kinds of ways to try to enliven the worship experience with these kinds of gimmicks. The problem is they work, but they miss the point. They really miss the point, because the problem is, I think, much deeper than simply trying to find new things to replace the old ones, because we're going to get tired with the new when they become old, just as we have gotten tired of the old. That isn't even the issue. The issue, I think, is really the secular consciousness, the secular culture in which we live. For the consequence of secularity does not mean that religious institutions die. We have learned that by looking at even the most militantly secular cultures in our world today. After, 60 years of communist power in Russia, the church is still alive there. There are still worshipers, even in a militantly secular state. In European countries, there's been sort of a kind of standoff between the religious part of the population and the secular part of the population. And in this country, religious institutions are positively thriving. America itself was founded virtually at the beginning of the secular consciousness, near the end of the Enlightenment. If you look at a dollar bill and see the great seal of the United States on it, are the Latin words Novus Ordo Cyclum. We are starting a new order in the ages. Hannah Arendt, in her book on revolution, points out that to set up a form of government in which there is no longer a king was a fundamentally secular act, because kings were God's way of running the world. And when we finally said, "We're going to not have a king," we were in a sense saying no to God's way of running the world. We didn't always put it that way, but it was a secular act. Yet in this country, in spite of the fact that our existence and the arising of the secular consciousness are practically identical, Church membership in this country has gone from 6% of the population at the time of the revolution to well over 60% today. So our institutions are alive and thriving, or at least holding their own. But the fundamental thing that has happened in a secular consciousness is the breakdown of the relationship of religion and ordinary experience. We do not know any longer what kinds of common, ordinary experiences are coming to expression in religious language, even the most central religious language, so that the argument about God is no longer which God, or let's say the argument between one religion and another, but the argument is now over whether God at all. So that belief now has come to mean belief in God's existence, you see. The whole problem of God is perceived differently. Once the question was, is God merciful? But now the question is simply, is God, you see. And when that happens, then religious language ceases to be public language. That is, the common language with which we give expression to publicly perceived experiences. The result, then, is that worship lacks reality itself. I have a New Yorker cartoon of a woman who is coming out of church bright-eyed, shaking hands with the minister and saying, "You make it all sound so real." Well, that is, in fact, the problem today. My colleague Ron Halls, who teaches Old Testament, tells his classes that if he were to do a miracle in front of his class, they wouldn't say, "God has visited his people." They would say, "Do it again slowly." In that way, you see, they are pointing up the problem that we have. If we see it often enough, we'll be able to figure out what it's all about. The result is that religion has been compartmentalized for most of us. And many of the things that we do in our gathering for worship don't really have any relationship to the way we experience life outside of worship. Now, sometimes we even prefer it that way. We want ministers to dress up in funny clothes, and we want, and all of a sudden it's appropriate, you see, in a building that looks like a church, has pointed windows and stained glass in them. In that kind of a context, it's all right to say, "God, do something or other. Change minds." But how does he do that? If we really want to figure out how to change minds, we don't go to God, we go to Madison Avenue. We go to subliminal advertising. We go to motivational studies. In short, we look at psychology to figure out how people change. In church, we say, "God, you change," or "You do this." But outside, we say, it's psychology that does it. That's only one illustration. One could go on and on to the fact, to illustrate the ways in which the things that we do in church don't really relate any longer to the way we function in life. 400 years ago, if you got sick, you would have called a doctor as your last resort. You'd go to the priest first, because God was, after all, believed by everyone to be the primary causal agent of sickness and health. And if the priest couldn't get God to do anything, then maybe, as a last resort, you would go to see a doctor. It couldn't hurt anymore to go. If you were about to take a journey, you would first of all go to the church, have a mass said for the safety of the journey. Today we buckle up, you see. I mean, it's that kind of a disrelation between what we do religiously and the way we actually function in our lives. So that even if most of us say, "Goodbye, God be with you," what's really important is that you take safety precautions along the way. Now, this means then that our the whole problem of faith and doubt has changed, as well as what happens in our worship. One of the most poignant statements of the so-called death of God is a section from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's marvelous, or as Tom Stoppard's marvelous play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. The Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are minor characters in Shakespeare's Hamlet, but Stoppard has made them the characters of his play, so that they're on stage all the time, just as we are on stage all the time to ourselves. And other people wander in and out of their lives, Hamlet and so on. Well, they're on their way to Elsinore, and they meet the players, who are also on the way to Elsinore, and the players offer to do a play for them there out in the woods. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern slip away while the play is going on, later meet the actors at Elsinore, and the actor, the chief player, reproaches them with this speech. It's just stunning. "You left us. We can't look each other in the face. You don't understand the humiliation of it. To be tricked out of the single assumption which makes our existence viable, namely, that somebody is watching the play. The plot was two corpses gone before we caught sight of ourselves, stripped naked in the middle of nowhere, pouring ourselves down a bottomless well. There we were, demented children, mincing about in clothes no one ever wore, speaking as no one ever spoke, swearing love in wigs and rhymed couplets, killing each other with wooden swords, hollow protestations of faith, hurled after empty promises of vengeance, and every gesture, every pose, vanishing into the thin, unpopulated air. But we're actors. We've pledged our identities, secure in the conventions of our trade, that someone would be watching, and then gradually no one was. We were caught high and dry. It was not until the murderer's long soliloquy that we were able to look around, frozen as we were in profile. Our eyes searched you out, first confidently, then hesitantly, then desperately, as each patch of turf, each log, every exposed corner in every direction proved uninhabited. Our heads began to move, wary as lizards. The corpse of unsullied Rosalinda peeped through his fingers, and the king faltered. Even then habit and a stubborn trust that our audience spied upon us from behind the nearest bush forced our bodies to blunder on long after they had emptied of meaning, until like runaway carts they dragged to a halt. No one came forward. No one shouted at us. The silence was unbreakable. It imposed itself upon us. It was obscene. We took off our crowns and swords and cloth of gold and moved silent on the road to Elsinore." Question he's asking here is really, is anybody watching the play? Lily Tomlin has this marvelous line in one of her acts, "If you talk to God, it's prayer. If God talks to you, you're nuts." And you see, and that's really where we are today. Where once people argued over who had the revelation, today the question is whether there's a revelation at all, and the people who claim there is are the ones who are thought to be nuts. All right, so I have one goal then in these series this week, and that is to ask relentlessly, what kinds of experiences common to us all, what kinds of experiences common to all of humanity come to expression in religious language, in worship? That is, how does our language once again become public language, have reality, relate in fact to life? And I want to begin with the notion that God and worship are going on continually, and that not all of it is comforting, that worship can also be, in fact, a terrifying moment. I want to read just a section from Romans 1 today that begins to take up that theme. And I think it'll be a good introduction to what we want to do. Paul begins in verse 18 of Romans 1, The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who by their wickedness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. And then comes the terror in this. Three times he uses the word par edoken, hand over, abandon, deliver over. Therefore God abandoned them to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God abandoned them to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged unnatural relations for unnatural, and men likewise, giving up natural relations with women, and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God abandoned them to a base mind, to improper conduct. They were filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but approve those who practice them. If we're going to ask about God's existence, that is God, then the question is one for which there is no answer. Partly because when we ask it, we ask a question, as one theologian has put it, without any risk. That is to say, without any involvement of ourselves, much as we would ask, does San Francisco exist? You know, I don't know whether it does or not. I live in Ohio, so what difference does it make whether San Francisco exists, you see? Or Karen shows Star Slides, and I will say to myself, does Andromeda exist? It's a kind of so what question. What if it does? What difference does it make? In a sense, none, you see. Does Moscow exist? I've never been. I've seen pictures, but I've never been there. So what, we could say. If we ask about God's existence, we are asking a kind of so what question. But that means already that we are asking the wrong thing, because you cannot ask about God in a so what way. Where then, in the structures of the world, does God bear witness to his own existence? Paul says everything that can be known about God is plain to us. I would say in three places in our existence today, we can find experiences that are not neutral, that are not so what kinds of experiences, but that confront us necessarily with the terror of asking about God. These are places where we are controlled and have no theoretical possibility of controlling in return, where we are controlled by things that are totally, inescapably beyond our control. First of them is birth. We use the word control together with birth. We talk about birth control. But the only births that we are controlling are somebody else's. We are never able to control our own. That is, the I, who is asking about God, is already here willy-nilly without anybody asking my permission. Wasn't asked what century I wanted to be born in, of what parentage, in what country, in what place. You know, I just happened to come from Minnesota. My parents are of German nationality. I had no choice in the matter. There isn't any way in which we can control our own existence, and that's terrifying. Paul Tillich says in a very trenchant insight that when our children ask us, where did they come from, they are not really asking for biological information. They are asking the most fundamental and, in a sense, terrifying existential questions. When our children discover, in a sense, how accidental their being here is, we might not have met, you say to them, if it hadn't been for. Or when we did meet initially, we didn't like each other at all. It's, you know, why did you get married? I don't know why we got married, you know. That's scary, because it really says, I might not have been here. Psychology Today did a study of the current generation, and even people who proclaim loudly their sexual liberation have great difficulty contemplating the sexual activity of their parents or the parental generation. You know, think about that for a moment. Most of us find it distasteful, to say nothing more than that, distasteful to think that our parents engaged in sex. And the reason is not Victorianism or prudery or anything like that. The reason is that most of us like to think of ourselves as self-caused, you see, as if we had always been around. You know, that's why to be confronted with the fact of our birth is suddenly to be confronted about the fact that there was a time when we were not. Now, we may try to master that time when we were not with history, with historical recreations of the past. We'll invent a history if we don't really have one. We want to have control of that past, and history is the way we do it. But we are terrified of the notion that we are not self-caused, because it also means that we are not self-perpetuating. Sigmund Freud's great insight, one of his great insights, is that all of us spend a good portion of our lives working on what he calls a causa sui project. That is, the project in which I want to determine my own existence, both in the past as well as in the future. And we are terrified by those reminders that we were not at one point in our existence. And that leads me then to the second place, where we have control over which, where we are controlled by something over which we have no control. You guessed it, the fact of our death. The death rate remains, John Streidelmeier says, one death per person. And there is no way we are going to alter that. We don't like to look at the fact of our own death, but it is there just the same. And the third place lies in between. The third structural element in our existence, which controls us and over which we have no control. And that is the fact of choice. Human beings are what sociologists call world-open beings. That is to say, it is not determined with my birth what I shall become. We have a schnauzer at home, a dog. It was determined with his birth what he was going to become. He has no alternative but to be a schnauzer. That isn't to say that that we can't train him. We do train him in a few ways. But he is committed to schnauzerdom all his life, and you can tell what it's going to be like. He's an instinctual creature, and that's the way he's going to function. But we are not determined by our birth what my vocation will be, you see, what kind of home I will have. I don't even know what kind of a house I'm going to live in 10 years from now. You see, beavers have been living in the same kind of lodges and dams as long as there have been beavers. Robins build the identical nest as long as there have been robins. People have built different kinds of habitations and confront us with a bewildering array, a bewildering variety of things. We are world open. What we will become is not given with our birth. That means we have choices available to us. But that, too, is a scary business because we have no choice about choice. There is no way we cannot choose. And the moment we become choosers, and we have no choice about that, we must be, in that moment we are also culpable. This means, then, that we are controlled by things over which we have no control, and in the midst of these things, we are also accountable. We are not simply victims of these forces. We are somehow involved in them in such a way that we can be held accountable for the choices that we make. Back to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. He has this marvelous actor's speech saying, "Is anybody watching the play?" But because the play is about the reality of life itself, listen to these interesting developments. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, there are fate themes all over the play, that is, powers that control. They begin the play with a coin flip, except that Rosencrantz has flipped the coin 76 times, and 76 straight times it has come up heads. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, there are fate themes all over the play, that is, powers that control. They begin the play with a coin flip, except that Rosencrantz has flipped the coin 76 times, and 76 straight times it has come up heads. And Guildenstern says, aren't you worried about that? What he's asking about is, where does the law of averages get suspended? It gets suspended at the point of our death. Half of us do not, on the average, survive, you see. That's why this ominous symbol at the beginning of the play. And then they were summoned. They were sent for. The voice, you know, the horseman leaps past the hotel where they're staying, summons them to Elsinore, and they go. The fate motif again. It seems as if they're the little people, harmless little people. We didn't do anything. When I was in Germany, they always said about the Hitler years, "Oh, die da oben, the ones up there, you know, we're just the little people." Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were those little people. But then the king involves them in his need to get rid of Hamlet. And so they are given a letter to deliver to the King of England as they accompany Hamlet to England. In the letter, the king is instructed to execute Hamlet on the spot. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern think they have lost the letter, find it, open it up, read it, and then comes this conversation. "But we're his friends." "How do you know?" "Why, from our young days we were brought up with him." "But you've only got their word for it." "But that's what we depend on." "Well, yes, and then again, no. Let's keep things in proportion. Assume, if you like, that they're going to kill him. Well, he's a man, and he's mortal. Death comes to us all, etc., and consequently he would have died anyway, sooner or later. Or look at it from the social point of view. He's just one man among many. The loss would be well within reason and convenience. And then again, what is so terrible about death? As Socrates so philosophically put it, since we don't know what death is it logical to fear it? It might be very nice. Certainly it is a release from the burden of life and for the godly a haven and a reward. Or look at it another way. We're little men. We don't know the ins and outs of the matter. There are wheels within wheels, etc. It would be presumptuous of us to interfere with the designs of fate or even of kings. All in all, I think we'd be well advised to leave well alone. Tie up the letter, there, neatly, like that. They won't notice the broken seal. But what's the point? Oh, don't apply logic. But he's done nothing to us. Or justice. It's awful. But it could have been worse. I was beginning to think it was. It might have been us. You see the point? They are willing to do it to him because we're just little men. We don't know the ins and the outs. We can't interfere with fate or kings. Hamlet, however, steals the letter, reads in it his own death warrant, substitutes a letter in which Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are to be killed. That was in the Shakespeare play, too. So the end comes, and Rosencrantz, standing alone on the side of the stage, everything dark, just the spotlight on him, says, "That's it, then, is it? The sun's going down, or the earth's coming up, as the fashionable theory has it. Not that it makes any difference. What was it all about? When did it begin? Couldn't we stay put? I mean, no one's going to come to drag us off. They'll have to wait. We're still young. We've got years. We've done nothing wrong. We didn't harm anyone, did we?" And then the spotlight on him extinguishes with that question. We didn't harm anyone, did we? Ah, yes, you see, but they did. And that's the terror of it. We cannot live within the structures of choice without harming one another. And we do. And God's judgment on this is that we are indeed accountable. We might try to escape accountability by manipulating our fate if we can, or by saying, "There is no God." Ivan in The Brothers Karamazov says, "When there is no God, then all is permitted, you see. Then we can do anything." But there is no way to escape either the control or the accountability that goes with it. And we only bear witness to both as we rush around trying to justify ourselves or to escape the accountability in one way or another. What we believe, therefore, determines how we behave. What we believe determines how we behave. And we bear witness to our belief in accountability, both by our attempts to escape and by our despair when escape is impossible. Our gods are not real. The ways we try to justify ourselves are illusory. They are lies, and God's judgment upon us is inexorable. We cannot eradicate our past. We cannot escape our future. That's why these terrible words of Paul, God gave them up to, God abandoned them to, their illusions, their lies, their gods. Worship is going on all the time, you see, as we take seriously our fate and our accountability, as we try to protect ourselves. Worship is going on, but it is false worship. The game that we are in is a serious game. That's the theme for this morning. Worship is serious. It really affects the whole of our existence. What we need, if we are going to be faithful worshipers as opposed to unfaithful, redemptive worshipers as opposed to destructive, what we need is a story big enough for the truth and for a redemptive life. It won't come easy, but there is such a story, and that's what I want to do tomorrow. Let me just conclude today with a word from C.S. Lewis. This is at the end of his introduction to Mere Christianity. He says, "In the long run, the Christian religion is a thing of unspeakable comfort. But it does not begin in comfort. It begins in dismay. And it is no use at all trying to go to the comfort without first going through the dismay. In religion, as in everything else, comfort is the one thing you cannot get by looking for it. If you look for the truth, you may find comfort in the end. But if you look for comfort, you will get neither comfort nor truth, only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin with, and in the end, despair. Well, the serious business of worship is that even when we think God is dead, he is not. We cannot escape him. And the encounter with him in the structures of life is a terrifying one. There is a story big enough for truth and redemption. That's what we'll talk about tomorrow. There is a story big enough for truth and redemption.